From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Voters head to the polls this morning to choose a nominee for president. And are wages an important issue for you? They are for many voters. Our colleague Venus Prather says before coming to GPB, pay inequality was something she faced.
Most women are paid at least $5 less than a man.
I think it's just status quo that they assume that women aren't worth what they're worth. And we are. We are. Because we work just as hard as most men. Sometimes harder.
That's coming up this hour. First, though, we talked to you yesterday about the presidential race. GPB's Bill Nigut talked about the deep divisions that Trump's candidacy have created within the Republican Party.
There's no question they are in deep crisis and they don't know what to do. What's really remarkable this weekend is you've now got mainstream Republican leaders, or at least establishment Republicans, who are breaking with the party.
So we asked you who has your vote this Super Tuesday, and here are your first thoughts.
My name is Brad Goidix, and I'm a software developer. Probably going to support Trump because he's going to get Mexico to pay for the wall. I think it's a problem that we need to solve, and I don't think that the wall is the total solution, but I think that it could help.
My name is Julie Ding, and I work at McKinsey & Company in their product development group. I think I'm split between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, mainly because just Donald Trump, I don't know how much of a supporter I am of him personally, but something between the other two would be good.
My name is Scott Jordan. I'm a software developer, and right now I'm probably Marco Rubio. He's the least offensive of all the choices I have left. I personally believe in a smaller government. He's the only one I hear talking about a smaller government at any point.
My name is Marvin Howard, and I work at the high-end car wash, Hot Spa Bistro. For me, I really don't care too much about politics at this point. So whoever wins, wins. I really don't think anything's going to change anyway, so...
Let's hear from you. What issues are important to you this election season, and are you voting in the primary? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. We might feature your comments on the show. For presidential candidates, Georgia is high-value territory. There are 76 Republican delegates up for grabs today and 102 Democratic delegates. Joining me now is Congressman John Lewis to answer some questions about this election season. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. I know you've endorsed Hillary Clinton. It's election day, so we can't advise anyone on how to cast your vote. But I'm so glad you're with us because I know that voters have a lot of questions. Can we start with what is going on? There's a lot of anger among voters, and it feels as though politics have gone a little bit off the rail. Do you have insight from your time in Washington?
Well, I've been here for a few years. I have never seen anything like this before. It's not just the voters. It's some of the candidates. It's almost a dogfight dog. Political campaigns are supposed to be a little more sane and rational, but it looked more like a playground fight. Children can play better than some of the candidates.
Do you think this is affect all politicians? Because there seems to be, I mean, they're making fun of American politics in other countries. There's a lot of disrespect from voters toward the political process at this point, and it can't be helping that the candidates are insulting one another. Is this going to have a negative effect, do you think, on how you do your job and other politicians?
Well, it will not have a negative effect on how I do my job. I'm going to continue to do the best possible job in representing the people of the 5th District of Georgia. I tell my colleagues from time to time of both sides of the aisle, pace yourself and respect others and never become bitter, never hate. The greatest need is to bring people together because we're all in this thing together. We're all in the American house, and we must look out for each other. During the Civil Rights Movement, during the 60s, we used to say over and over again, maybe our foremothers and our forefathers all came to this great land, to this great country in different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. And I think that truth still holds today. It doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat, you're supporting one candidate over another candidate. Let's just be civil. Let's get along. Let's work together for the common good.
Do you have any idea? We've seen a larger turnout among GOP voters during the primary season, but turnout among the Democrats has been lower. Any idea why?
Well, I think Democrats tend to be a little slow in getting our act together. After the primary is over, you're going to see the Democrats coming together all across America and electing the best possible candidate.
Do you think that there's been any effect from voter ID laws? We're just beginning to see some studies on the effect that strict voter ID laws have had, especially in places like Georgia. Do you think that's affecting turnout?
I do think in certain areas of Georgia and other parts of the country, in some of the rural areas where you have many people without ID, and in the elderly population, minority population, they cannot afford it. People don't have a driving license. They don't drive cars.
And so they're not able to get in to vote to get their ID, or that prevents them from getting to the polling place?
That is happening in so many places, not just in the state of Georgia, but all across America. After the Supreme Court gutted the heart and soul of the Voting Rights Act, more than 32 states have changed their voting laws to make it harder, more difficult for a lot of people to participate. I have said in the past that the vote is precious. It's almost sacred. It is the most powerful, nonviolent instrument or tool that we have in a democratic society. We should make it easy. Make it simple.
Well, and I know you have been pushing in Congress to try to get legislators to revamp the Voting Rights Act and fix what was removed by the Supreme Court. Is there anything going on behind the scenes that we haven't heard about to make that happen?
Well, we're working together and pulling together. We're talking on the Democratic side. Some members on the Republican side are talking. And we're going to come up with a piece of legislation, and we will introduce it. And hopefully we will be able to pass it.
Do you think that Georgia's primary vote matters more at this point because we now have the SEC primary? Do you hear more talk about candidates getting into the state more?
Well, I think the primary vote is so important in a state like Georgia. Georgia is a very diverse state, and it's growing very fast. And you come out of Georgia with a solid support, you're on your way.
So can I go back to some of the sort of craziness happening in this political season? And I wonder if the door is open now, if we have expanded the number of candidates, the kind of candidate who can run a legitimate campaign for president and win a primary. Does that sort of affect every presidential season that comes after this?
Well, I think what we're witnessing now, it is sort of opening up the process. And you're going to see more and more people running, not with the blessing of their political party. People are just going to get out there and run. And you may have a season where more and more independent candidates will try to run. And you may have a third party. It could well happen. Right now, especially on the Republican side.
Do you think that's a good thing?
Well, I think if people want to run and get out there, and I think it's healthy. But I do believe in a structure that we have. We need at least two strong, viable political parties.
So going back to the sort of the anger that voters feel, and we, in talking to voters, have heard both anger and then apathy from some people. There almost seems to be nothing in between. And in your speaking with constituents, what do you hear? What do you think is the source of the anger?
Well, I hear people saying over and over again, why don't you all get along? Why don't you work together? And why don't you get something done? And I said, you know, I'm working. I work every single day. I continue to work day and night. Not just when I'm in Washington, but when I'm in Georgia or some other parts of America. I spend a lot of time listening to people, going to schools, going to churches, going to synagogues, in the streets, in the restaurants.
But that's you, one individual congressman. What about the rest of Congress?
Well, I visit other members' districts, both Democrats and Republican district, and I talk with people and listen to people. But people, some of my colleagues live in fear that if they say the wrong thing, if they vote the wrong way, they think the citizenry will be coming after them. I said, just do what is right. Just be fair. Listen to the people and follow their lead.
Is it possible that we simply are in constant campaign mode in American politics, that legislators never really stop campaigning?
Well, when you look at the election for members of the House, you know, we run every other year. People say every 2 years. We run. We're constant running. We're constant campaigning. And there are people now probably looking toward 4 years from now to run for president or the House or the Senate. They're looking ahead. But we have to govern. And when you elect someone, don't forget about them. Stay in touch. Stay in tune with them.
So how crucial do you think this presidential election is, especially considering all of the issues that affect African-Americans and Latinos and the non-white population of the country? How important would you say this particular election in November is?
This election is very, very important. I have witnessed and been involved probably in every campaign since the election of President Kennedy in 1960. And I have never, ever seen it like this. The world is watching. The world is saying, what is happening? What is going on in America? When President Obama was elected 8 years ago, and you travel through Europe, there was so much hope, so much optimism. But if you go there today, people witnessing what is happening in our campaign, they're saying, what's going wrong? Are we losing our way?
That is Democratic Congressman John Lewis of Atlanta. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And, of course, we encourage everyone to go out and vote no matter what your politics are. We've gotten a few tweets from you. We got one from Jay Tirado, who says, for this primary, I'm voting for the candidate who best addresses justice issue in all its forms, hashtag Super Tuesday. And Amanda Beth says, I voted early in Athens last week. And we got another one from, says, yes, had mine in early voting. My first time voter daughter insists on hashtag feel the burn. Tell us whether you're voting and possibly who you're voting for. We're going to explain the role of superdelegates in choosing a president because that can be confusing. But first, we'll focus on a major election issue in this campaign that Hillary Clinton and her rival Bernie Sanders have both talked about.
Up and down the ladder, many women are paid less for the same work.
We have to pass pay equity for women workers. It is not acceptable that women are making 78 cents an hour compared to men.
Just ahead, the pay gap between men and women. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The wage gap between men and women in the South is larger than any other region in the country. Women in the South earn just 79.5% of a man's earnings. A new report from the Institute for Women's Policy Research found the gender wage gap costs Southern women more than $150 billion a year. That's billion with a B. Chandra Childers is a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Good morning, Chandra.
Good morning.
And Jessica Milley is an economist and the study director at the Institute. Thanks for joining us as well, Jessica.
Happy to be here.
Chandra and Jessica both worked on that report here in Atlanta. Charmaine Davis joins me. She's the state director of the Georgia chapter of 9-to-5 Working Women. That's a nonprofit group that's designed to improve conditions for women in the workplace. Welcome to the program, Charmaine.
Thank you. Good morning.
And according to this report, Charmaine, you have your work cut out for you. Pardon the pun.
Mm-hmm.
Any of this was a surprise to you?
No, none of it came as a surprise. Like, I'm a community organizer. That's my background. So I'm constantly working with women directly impacted by the wage gap and hearing their stories of being fired or being passed up for promotion. So it wasn't a a surprise.
So, Chandra, can we dig into where exactly this wage gap is? And we can follow it down the thread to what's causing it. But is there a huge difference depending on what your profession is?
Yes. Actually, the occupations that men and women hold, you know, you talk about leading down to the cause, that is actually a big part of the gender wage gap. It's not all, it does not explain all of the gender wage gap, but it is a big part of the differences in earnings between men and women. Some other things, though, that kind of factor in, if we're looking at the differences in earnings between men and women, we also see big differences by race and ethnicity, as well as by the occupations that men and women hold.
I want to play for you, Jessica, this comment from Julie Ding. She works in product development for a private consulting firm here in Atlanta, and she says she has never actually experienced any wage discrimination.
Working in a male-dominated field, I really feel that a lot of the success that I've had as a woman has really just been attributed to the fact that I've tried hard to kind of assimilate and do what I can. So sometimes I do feel like the whole feminism movement is a little whiny, I guess, but I don't know. I just think as a woman in the South in STEM, as long as you work hard and have your mind set on a good goal, then I really don't feel like there's any discrimination.
So, Jessica, that's how she feels, but what does the data tell us?
Well, there's a number of things that we can say about that. One of the big things, though, is that even though women might feel like they're getting their fair share, a lot of women in the private sector and even men in the private sector have reported that they are either prohibited or strongly discouraged from discussing their pay with their coworkers. So a lot of women don't even know that this is happening. I mean, they see this wage gap figure in the news, but, you know, they don't know if that's specifically happening to them. So that's a huge issue. And there are a number of laws trying to tackle this issue of pay transparency being introduced now.
Let me bring that to you, Charmaine. Is that something that you hear as well from women? Maybe some of them aren't even aware that they're making considerably less?
Not so much that they are not aware. My experience is that they're very much aware that something is wrong in their workplace, because the wage gap doesn't just play out in he's doing one position, she's doing the exact same position, they're making two different pay rates. But it goes back to what Chandra was pointing out, that there's just a devaluing of the work that has historically been done by women. So industries that have large female working populations, you'll see that overall they make less. So you see women overrepresented in minimum wage jobs. So that plays a huge role. Also, I think that it also plays out because there's a lack of worker protections in the South. So I talk to working mothers who are like, well, I was penalized or I was fired because I need to stay home to take care of my child. Well, if you're being penalized or you're being fired for having caregiving responsibilities, and we know that women take on the bulk of caregiving responsibilities, you're obviously not being promoted and moved up or seeing an increase in compensation. So a lot of times the wage gap is justified in the workplace by simply saying, well, this person had to take off to care for their children, or this person wasn't here or whatever. And we need to challenge that and say that our workplace policies need to change to accommodate the fact that women do take on more caregiving responsibilities. So the women that I talk to are aware I'm being penalized because I'm a mother or I have caregiving responsibilities. And so maybe they don't say wage gap, but they're articulating that they're facing some type of penalties on the job because of their role as a woman, as a caregiver, as a provider for their family.
Chandra, an interesting thing is we just, for the first time in history in the United States, we just found that single women outnumber married women. How does that affect, does marital status affect a woman's wage?
There, I think there's some research that shows, actually, I think the differences with children, between women with children and women without, with what Charmaine was just saying, that is one of the, that having children or not having children and the demands of childcare, of being a caregiver, it influences earnings in the workplace. I don't know necessarily that I've seen anything about the difference between married women and single women absent child-rearing responsibilities.
Well, I just want to also point out that we see that the wage gap is smallest when a woman is under 30, unmarried, and doesn't have children. And so that's why I continue to make the argument that as long as we have workplace policies that penalize women for having caregiving responsibilities, we're going to continue to see the wage gap remain stagnant.
We got this tweet from the AFL-CIO of Georgia who says, Research typical minimum wage workers is 30-year-old female with children. Legislators failed again to even hold a vote on raising wages. And I should mention that research has shown us, and Jessica, you or Chandra can correct me, that but in the past it's shown that when a woman has children, her wages go down, whereas when a man has kids, he generally gets a raise. Isn't that correct?
That is definitely something that we see in the data.
So how does this, one of the things that you point out in this report is that if we fixed the wage gap, it would actually pull a huge number of women out of poverty. How is that, Jessica?
Well, if you take women that have the same educational attainment, they're of the same age, they live in the same region of the country, they're living in the same metro urban area. If you were to pay them the same as comparable men, so similar on all of those characteristics, that would increase earnings for women by a substantial amount. And I believe in the South, that was about $6,000, a little over $6,000 a year. And that really adds up. If you add that to family incomes, that's enough to pull millions of families out of poverty. And in fact, we see in a lot of states that that's sufficient to cut the poverty at least in half.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Chandra Childers, Jessica Milley with the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and also Charmaine Davis is with the nonprofit group 9to5. And we're speaking about the gender pay gap here in Georgia. I want to read this tweet from T. Barf, who says, hopefully you'll be able to tease out that the wage gap comes primarily from life career choices and not systemic discrimination. And that's kind of echoed by this Georgia Tech grad student, Brian Hayes. We asked him why he thinks there is such a large wage gap.
The jobs that provide the flexibility that maybe women need don't pay as much as the jobs that that men have that don't have as much flexibility. And maybe just in terms of travel, you have to travel today. You know, maybe a woman who needs to take care of her family can't do that.
Jessica, statistics bear that out? If we removed, if we controlled for the choice of job, like teacher or nurse, would that remove the wage gap?
It certainly has an impact on the ratio of earnings, but it doesn't get rid of it completely. Even in our research, when we look at the wage gap across occupations, we still see a substantial gap. I think part of what's still in existence when we remove that is this impact of expectations. So going back to what Charmaine and Chandra were saying earlier, you know, even if you aren't married or if you don't have kids, there's this expectation that you're probably at some point going to have them. And even though we've moved towards more progressive gender roles within the household, women are still taking on the bulk of the caregiving responsibility. I was just reading a report the other day that said that in the tech industry, a large majority of women, I think 75% or so, were asked about marital status, family plans, and so on and so forth during interviews. And about 40% of women said that they felt that they need to talk less about their families in order to be taken seriously at work. So there's still those expectations in the workforce, even within certain occupations.
anecdotally, and I know this doesn't affect the statistics, T-Barf, I can answer you that I have been paid less than my male counterparts for exactly the same job for most of my professional career. So it wasn't career choice, certainly for me. And I want to play this comment from Venus Prather, who is one of our colleagues here at GPB. Before she came to GPB, she worked as a painter at a university, and she did not get paid as much as her male coworkers.
I asked my supervisor, why does he make more than I make? And he just came in the door. I've been here 5 years. I don't make half of what this man make. Why? And the only thing they could tell me was he had more experience. But he didn't, because he would come in and I'd have to train him.
And Charmaine, she actually took her case to the state. She eventually won. She got her pay raise, but it took her a huge amount of time. Mm-hmm. And you're nodding your head. This is typical for women that have issues over their pay.
Well, yeah, and for a lot of women, they don't, excuse me, they don't have large periods of time. You know, these are working women. They have responsibilities, maybe children, other responsibilities that they have to take care of. And so you're using this example of her case. Well, this drug out over a period of time. There's a lot of women who aren't fortunate enough or just don't have the resources to fight something like this all the way through.
And so, she also worked for the state, so there was a mechanism in place for her to do that.
Yeah, which is a little different than most of us who are employed by private employers.
So, Chandra, if it's not just because of career choice, that may be a large chunk of it, but what is the rest of it? What else causes the rest of that pay gap?
There are a number of things. One, I kind of want to go back to something Charmaine said earlier in the devaluation of the work that women do. You know, Jessica mentioned that when we looked at the impact of closing that gender wage gap, we were looking at comparable men and women with the same education, same age, living in the same region. So we see that jobs where women are disproportionately overrepresented, those jobs tend to pay less. So jobs like teaching and healthcare, those are jobs that tend to be devalued. Some of the pay gap, it's discrimination. When we look at economic research that controls for all of the things that we say for human capital, for education, when we control for those differences, we still find that there is a significant portion of that pay gap that results from, you know, where women are employed, which again has some built-in discrimination and other factors that don't get accounted for. But we see that that is a part of the jobs women are hired into, where they're assigned, job assignment. We do see other differences in the pay that women make. And as we're talking in promotion rates, in pay increases. So those things also factor into that pay gap.
We got a quote, a tweet, I should say, again from T-Barf, who says, wait, John and Susie get together and have a kid, so John's employer gives him a raise and Susie's boss cuts her pay? I'm calling BS. In case you don't believe the statistic, T-Barf, I can absolutely send to you some links that show definitively that, in fact, mothers are less likely to be hired for jobs. They're less likely to be perceived as competent at work or be paid as much as their male colleagues with the same qualifications if they had kids. But a man is more likely to be hired if he has kids, and they're paid more after they have children. There are arguments, Jessica, though, about how much the pay gap is. And when the White House released when President Obama mentioned that women are paid 77 cents on the dollar, there was a huge outcry from people saying that's not accurate. Do we have an accurate amount about how much the wage gap is?
Well, I think that this number actually is pretty accurate in measuring the disparity in earnings between men and women, because it has all of those things built into it, like differences in occupations, differences in how employers treat mothers and fathers, and so on and so forth. These are all factors that matter, and this figure is capturing that. If we all of a sudden just ignore all of these things that are causing it, then we're really not, you know, adequately assessing the problem. And I think this statistic is so shocking, and it's something that will hopefully start catalyzing change.
We only have about a minute left. We're going to continue this conversation in a moment. But Charmaine, are women also not as good negotiators? That's another thing that we've heard in terms of getting raises and higher pay.
Well, I think in general, like, our workforce isn't really conditioned to negotiate for salaries, but especially
everybody,
women.
Men and women.
But especially with women. And that's why at 9to5, we have workshops, interview skill workshops, where we're teaching women how to research, you know, what is the going pay rate for whatever position that you're applying for and how to confidently negotiate for it. Because with all of us, because we see that exists with people of color and women, you're just not being trained or you're not ever taught that you can negotiate for a salary.
We have Chandra Childers with us. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Hi again, Chandra.
Yes, I'm here.
Jessica Milley is an economist and study director of the Institute. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
And Charmaine Davis is the state director of the Georgia chapter of 9to5 Working Women. It's a nonprofit designed to help improve conditions for women in the workplace. Hi, Charmaine.
Hello again.
Jessica, how much of the wage gap would be fixed, do we know, should we increase transparency? If we all knew what everybody was making, would it address this wage gap?
I don't know if there's any research out there that shows exactly how much impact that would have, but we do know that more than half the workforce, again, is either prohibited or discouraged from discussing pay with their coworkers. And that's definitely a good first step in addressing the pay gap. I mean, if you don't know how much you're earning relative to your coworkers, how can you possibly take steps to rectify the situation? But then you have all of these issues of, okay, what do I do now? What do I do to bring this up to my supervisor? What are the proper channels to go about getting this fixed? A lot of women might be intimidated by that process, or even as Charmaine was saying earlier, you know, that process can really drag out, and working women just don't have the time for that. So I'm not really sure how much the gap would be eliminated due to pay transparency, but it would definitely help.
Well, Charmaine, I know in my case, when I found out I was making literally half of what somebody in the exact same job was making, there was a problem because I wasn't supposed to have that information.
Mm-hmm.
So it was difficult for me to bring up because then it would be an issue of who told me. Right?
Yeah. I think in those situations, transparency would help. I think transparency is a necessary first step. But going back to what we've been saying, just the work that has been historically done by women is devalued. So I think we need to address, why do we think that it's okay to pay someone more to take care of our car than to take care of our child? Like, that's, you know, kind of at the root and at the heart of the wage gap. We devalue the work that women do. And transparency also doesn't get at why are women being penalized for having caregiving responsibilities in the workplace? Why aren't we thinking through policies that would make it easier for people who have those responsibilities to balance them, and not only balance, but to advance in their career?
Interesting questions. That is Charmaine Davis. She is with the nonprofit group 9to5, talking about the gender pay gap here in Georgia. And Chandra Childers and Jessica Milley are with the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Chandra, Jessica, Charmaine, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Today is Super Tuesday. Georgia will hold its primary election, and so will 11 other states. But Bernie Sanders may have lost the Democratic nomination for president weeks ago in New Hampshire. Sanders and Clinton have been neck and neck in the polls, but the superdelegates have given most of their votes to the former first lady. How can you win a primary but lose the delegate count? To understand that, you have to understand how superdelegates work. It's time to break it down.
Break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again.
Break it down. Superdelegates were invented in 1984. That is, they invented a thing that most people call superdelegates.
Faster than a speeding ballot, it's superdelegate to the rescue.
The political parties call them unpledged delegates.
Toga! Toga!
The Democrats have far more of them, and the supers in the Democratic Party can actually decide an election. The GOP supers probably can't.
You can't do that to our pledges. Only we can do that to our pledges.
Let's deal with the Republicans right away because their system is simple. The GOP awards 3 unpledged delegates to every state in the nation, but party rules say those delegates have to vote according to the primary election results. If one person gets 2/3 of the vote, then 2 unpledged delegates vote for that guy. It's simple.
Easy peasy lemon squeezy.
Not so for the Democrats, and I'll tell you why. Back in the 1980s, leaders in the Democratic Party became worried that party leaders and officials didn't have enough power in the nominating process. Why? Well, back in 1972, the Democrats nominated George McGovern of South Dakota.
I accept your nomination with a full and grateful heart.
But McGovern lost in every state except Massachusetts in November. Nixon won by a landslide.
I've never known a national election when I would be able to go to bed earlier than tonight.
4 years later, Jimmy Carter won the nomination despite strong opposition from the party's leaders. Some even launched an ABC campaign. No, not that one. ABC as in the Anybody But Carter movement. But it didn't matter. The Watergate scandal made voters wary of establishment politicians. Carter was seen as an outsider who might shake up D.C. politics, and he won both the nomination and the presidency.
And I guarantee you that it will be the year when we give the government of this country back to the people of this country.
The Democratic Party didn't want that to happen again. So in 1982, the party set aside 14% of the delegates as so-called superdelegates. Like I said, these people are automatically invited to the party's convention, and they get to vote for whomever they want in the primaries. Since the 1980s, the number of superdelegates has steadily grown. They now control about 30% of the votes, and that's more than enough to decide who becomes the nominee.
Boy, that escalated quickly.
How do you become a superdelegate? Well, you have to be a Democrat first. Then you have to be a member of the U.S. Congress, the governor of a state, or a high-ranking member of the party. You can also be a former president, vice president, or leader of the House or Senate.
It'll be easy peasy lemon squeezy.
No, it won't. It will be difficult, difficult, lemon difficult.
There are 4,483 delegates to the Democrats' convention. 714 are supers.
Superdelegate to the rescue!
Does the system work? Well, there's no easy answer to that. I can say definitively that it didn't work in 1984. That's when superdelegates helped push Walter Mondale into the nomination over Senator Gary Hart. Mondale lost 49 states that fall.
Unpledged delegates exist really to make sure that party leaders and elected officials don't have to be in a position where they are running against grassroots activists.
That was a Democratic National Committee Chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She was doing an interview on CNN. Critics took that response there as an admission that the system is rigged, at least on the Democratic side. But is it? We have brought in an expert to help weigh the pros and cons of the superdelegate system. Sean Ritchie is a political science professor at Georgia State University. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
First of all, did we get the superdelegate system basically right?
Yeah, I think you did an excellent job explaining it.
Okay, so one of the things I found interesting was how much the number of superdelegates, and again, we're talking on the Democratic side because on the Republican side, it's kind of not an issue. Fair?
Yeah, that's right.
So on the Democratic side, the number of superdelegates has increased hugely in the past few decades. Why?
Well, you got to remember that this is a kind of a longer history. Traditionally in American politics, this is the famous sort of somewhat stereotypical, but basically real description of men in a smoke-filled room deciding who's going to be the candidate. That was a traditional way of deciding it, and it wasn't always true like that. There's been changes over the party system, but basically as a sort of a movement away from that and a way to more really engage with the actual people and to actually allow a more truly democratic process where the nominee would be selected by the will of the people. Basically, that was changed to the primary system where we have today. But too much of the will of the people would sometimes lead to a suboptimal candidate being selected to be the
like
nominee.
George McGovern or Jimmy Carter.
That's right. Well, Carter won, but
yeah.
McGovern didn't. And so just sort of back off some of the non-optimal selection processes that the masses might select, basically the superdelegates were brought in. The fundamental problem is the primary voters differ from general election voters. They differ in two ways. A, they're just from the party, so it doesn't include independents in at least in closed primary states. But they also differ because of there's very low turnout in primaries. And so these tend to be people who are very engaged with politics and when people who are very interested in politics. And that correlates highly with ideological extremity. So you end up with the people who actually go and bother to vote in primary elections are – on average, more ideologically extreme than will be voting in the
general.
They're
one extreme or the other. So is that a way of saying that if the Republicans had more superdelegates that they wouldn't be in danger of having Donald Trump as their nominee?
Well, the issue is that superdelegates are often a sort of a moot question. So if we go back, say, even a contested primary that was probably more contested than people remember was 2012 with Mitt Romney. You remember Santorum and Gingrich ran pretty strong campaigns. But Romney had wrapped it up. Superdelegates or not superdelegates, even if you had had the same percentage of superdelegates at the Democratic side, and even if all of them had went to Santorum, Romney had wrapped it up by mid-March, early April.
But that's the Republican side.
Right.
I think a lot of people were confused, especially coming out of New Hampshire with the Democrats, because New Hampshire's a state that Bernie Sanders won by a landslide, and yet Hillary Clinton walked away with more delegates than Sanders did. Because of the supers.
Right. Well, not through the electoral process, because the superdelegates can choose at any point.
Anybody they want.
Right. And they can also change. So, for example, one person had previously selected Martin O'Malley, and I assume that person will change at some point.
Oh, they can change at any point all the way up to the convention?
Yeah, they can change their mind.
Meaning that if somebody – let's say that – now, no pollster is predicting this. Let's say Bernie Sanders wins Supers Tuesday by a landslide all across the country.
Right.
Those supers could then change to make him the nominee.
And let's say Hillary Clinton was to drop out. Well, then, of course, they're not going to go to the convention in Philadelphia and say, I'm voting for Hillary Clinton. She had already dropped out. And that's very much the case of what happened in 2008, because remember, lots of superdelegates in 2008 had supported her over Barack Obama. But by the time the convention came, they were not pushing the issue because Clinton was no longer running.
But here's the thing, Sean. Is the system then, at least for the Democrats, rigged? Was it a done deal? When people talked about Hillary Clinton being inevitable, is part of that because the party had already decided that the superdelegates would go to Clinton?
Well, the superdelegates do not make up that large of a percentage to decide it in that level, right?
So, but they get 30% of the delegate
true, count. And she had wrapped up a lot. But basically, because of this process whereby they can change their mind and so on, if there was if for example, Bernie Sanders was able to win, say he does very, very well tonight and continues to win, most assuredly he will be the nominee. Polling doesn't suggest that's going to happen, but if it was to happen, then he will win outright.
That would surprise everybody, I think.
Yeah.
So how would one – let's say – and we got this tweet from Crone who says superdelegates shouldn't exist in a democracy.
Uh-huh.
So let's say that you are in the Democratic Party and you want to bring up this issue to get rid of superdelegates or at least reduce them. How does that process happen?
Well, there's party rules. Interestingly, these are selected by the party themselves. Remember, parties are not in the Constitution. They're not unconstitutional.
Right.
They're extra-constitutional. They can exist. They're an association, and they're protected by the First Amendment because we have a rights to association. But they are not these processes by which parties select rules. That's why the Republican and Democratic Party differ are not legally bound. The parties have to agree on it, and they can differ in the way they can agree
so
on it.
So something the Democrats decide to do as a party cannot be either constitutional or unconstitutional because they're not in the Constitution.
That's basic. Well, I mean, they can do unconstitutional acts like the variety of unconstitutional acts
they
could do.
Shut down First Amendment speech.
Right, that kind of stuff, right. But basically, any rules of how the party go about deciding a nominee is their business.
So what does that mean? That means that somebody who's a member of the Democratic Party has no say?
Well, I think what it means is that if there – and remember, this has not happened yet. But if there was to ever be a so-called brokered convention where, say, the delegates are very close and maybe it looks like Sanders is going to win, but the superdelegates give it to Clinton – we've never had a situation like that. But if there was, there would be so much controversy over it and there would be so much turmoil and it would be such a negative way to start a general election campaign that I'm sure you would see massive reform thereafter.
Okay. If I were a former president, I am not, but if I were a high-ranking member of the Democratic Party, could I instigate a change in the rule or a vote?
Well, like any formal process, there are people who are on a rules committee, and the rules committee are elected and
by
people who are in the Democratic National Convention, and probably selected also by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's
the chair of the DNC.
Yeah, so they constitute committees and subcommittees, and then there could be some special ad hoc committee created for this purpose, probably, and then who's ever on that committee would develop some report, and then that report would be eventually selected.
So it's this big bureaucratic process, most likely the average Democrat is never going to have any say whatsoever.
Right, but even more likely is this is not going to be much of an issue, because it's never happened that superdelegates ever flipped an election from against the
popular
will.
That's never happened.
Well, remember, superdelegates are only from 72, and so we're talking about, for the Democratic side, you're talking about McGovern, you're talking
Carter,
you're talking about Mondale. Mondale was close with Hart, but basically Hart dropped out, so that doesn't count. And then you would have Dukakis, who was a clear winner. Clinton and Gore, and then Kerry and Obama.
Okay. We did get a tweet from J. Allen Harris, who says, "Superdelegates definitely sway results on the Democrat side. Look at the math." And you can tweet us as well if you have an opinion on superdelegates, whether you be a Republican or a Democrat, although Republicans don't really have to worry about that. You can tweet us at OSD Talk, or you can join the conversation that happens on Facebook. My guest is Georgia State University political science professor Sean Ritchie, talking about superdelegates. We only have about 30 seconds, but do you think that the issue, the identity crisis occurring over Trump, would make Republicans think more about adding superdelegates?
Well, that's exactly what this system is designed for. And so going forward is something they if they eventually elect Trump and he doesn't do well, it's something they'll certainly think about increasing.
Sean Ritchie, political science professor at Georgia State University, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is our show for today, but I want to harken back to the conversation we had about the gender wage gap, something which is particularly bad in the South. Southern women lose about $150 billion to that wage gap every year. And I wonder if you get paid less than a guy doing the same job, have you experienced that wage gap yourself? Call us and tell us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.